Information. Good conversation. Unabashedly Wisconsin, you're listening to Up North News.
Welcome back to the second hour of Up North News for this Tuesday, October 18th. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Aaron Zalmers is in the producer chair down in Madison. Dr. Kristen Lyerly joins us from the Green Bay area. But she's got a Viking horn helmet thingy on with the braids. I feel like I'm watching a Bugs Bunny cartoon where he's doing the opera.
Yeah, there we go.
Forgive the early morning language, but what the hell is that?
This is a tribute to Hans during our last segment when he was talking about, was it even on the air when he was talking about it?
No.
He was mentioning that his parents were immigrants, but not, you know, he didn't have a helmet with horns and braids, but
knew,
I just happened to.
I knew I should have put on my Brewers hat this morning. I'm going to get it, Pat, if I have.
There you go. You do that, and then you turn your camera on. You're hearing Pat McBride, our guest for this hour, and we're going to formally introduce him in just a sec right after I say if you want to get in touch with the show, 715-388-7155 or radio at upnorthnewswi.com. There he is now. And now you and Kristen, I guess, go way back. So I guess I have to ask, Kristen, you only get a Dr. Lyerly once an hour or so. Are we doing Dr. McBride right off the top here and then Patrick or Pat right after that?
It's hard for me not to call you Dr. McBride.
Okay. That works for me.
Well, because can I just talk a little bit about my relationship with Dr. McBride?
You can,
and how
but do you have to have the helmet on while you're doing it? I mean,
until we change, because I'm having a little bit of a headphone issue.
Oh, okay.
Don't worry, I've got my Bucks hat right here.
Oh, okay.
We'll change to that. But the reason that we are here with the amazing Dr. Pat McBride is because when Dr. McBride and I first met, I was a student at the University of Wisconsin Medical School, and he was the dean of students at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. So it would not be incorrect to say that I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Pat McBride. Not only was he the dean, but he was also a visionary leader as the University of Wisconsin Medical School transitioned to become the first school of medicine and public health, emphasizing that public health is a key component for all of us. So what he has done as part of the leadership team at the medical school is incredibly important and totally consistent with all of the other cool stuff that he's done in his life. So as we got to know each other a little bit better, turns out he has this unbelievable history of engagement, like serious engagement, this is what we're going to talk about, with sports teams in this state, including the Bucks, such an incredible story, the Brewers, amazing, and even the Packers. Like Pat McBride was there. So we'll hear lots about that, as well as his upbringing, which was complicated, growing up in an alcoholic household with a large family, and how he has been resilient and really been able to rise above to become the incredible person that he is. So with that, I would say welcome, Dr. Pat McBride.
Now, all Thank of this you. Ended up in a book called Luckiest Boy in the World. Is that right?
There it is.
There it is, the luckiest boy in the world. How long ago did you start writing it? When did it publish? And you know what would people what will people get out of it?
Well, I actually started writing it 50 years ago, but the truth is in about 2 years ago. It's written with my twin brother, who's I've known him every minute of my life, of course, and he's the mayor of Wauwatosa, our hometown, and I. He did a great job helping me out on this. And the book is really the arc of the story that Dr. Lyerly just told. And it's about us growing up in an amazing family and having a rough go of it. And then having these miracles happen where I got to work with all three professional sports teams in Wisconsin as a kid. And that completely changed my life.
And then, you know, from there, deciding to, you know, go into medical school. And then, we, you know, Kristen already mentioned everything in your health and medicine career that came after that. You know, we've got a couple of minutes till our first break. So I guess let's set the scene this way in terms of, your childhood. While I grew up with, you know, an alcoholic grandfather, it was not something that was abusive. It was more just kind of, you know, embarrassing. He would just talk to the wall all night, you know, and things like that. So I feel like I got the best of a possible bad lot. I mean, what would be the best 1 minute way to describe what it was like in your household?
Well, let me just tell you that I had two incredible parents. They were both newspaper reporters. My mother covered the White House. She ran JFK's campaign, but they would argue every night and they would scream and fight. It was a household that was impossible to really get anything done in. It was really, really tough. They were wonderful till about 5:30 at night, and then it was screaming and fighting. And so the seven kids of us would try to go to somebody else's house for dinner or homework or whatever. And so we learned how to manage that. It was not easy. But meanwhile, we learned a lot of things from these two reporters that were doing incredible things. My dad wrote for the Milwaukee Journal, wrote for something called The Green Sheet, which almost everybody in Milwaukee.
Oh, yes. Knows. Yep. Yep.
He wrote two columns. And my mother made multiple trips to the White House. So I met multiple presidents, which is in the book.
Just so much to get in such a bifurcated way. Again, something I can really relate to and look forward to talking about on the other side of this break. Pat McBride here, along with Kristen Lyerly, back in 2 minutes. You're up north. Degrees right now in Wausau, 36 in Richland Center, 34 in Oshkosh, 25 degrees in Amory. Not going to get terribly much warmer. Might get back into the 40s, but it's just going to continue to be a cool couple of days here before a slight warm up back to the 50s and 60s. I'm Pat Kreitlow. This is Up North News for Tuesday, October 18th. Dr. Kristen Lyerly with us as well, along with Dr. Patrick McBride, who has written the book, The Luckiest Boy in the World, all about growing up in a dysfunctional household, but then later being in the front row, actually even closer than the front row, for the Bucks, the Packers, the Brewers, and then a career in health and medicine. And Dr. McBride, before we went to break, we were just kind of starting to set the scene with parents who were amazingly talented, you know, and smart, but would succumb to, you know, too much liquor every night, have these big fights. You and your six siblings had to find, you know, other ways, you know, around the house. Like I said, I grew up with somebody who, again, when they were sober, best person in the world. And it's a mystery, I guess, to people, like, well, if you know you're so great when you're sober, why are you like this? Why do you have the drinks? And, you know, how did you come to, you know, did you ever come to a place of peace or understanding as you discovered, you know, addictive behavior and what made them different than other people?
Yeah, you know, growing up was so embarrassing and humiliating, because a lot of times the fights led to the police being called and the police coming over, and then there'd be three police cars out front with lights going. I still have a hard time when I see police lights, because it reminds me of that time, and the neighbors would all line up across the street. And then, so everybody in town knew about it. Milwaukee knew about it. You know, and I couldn't bring dates over for homecoming or prom, and even friends over, you know, I felt like it was too embarrassing and things like that, you know? So, you know, at school it would come up, you know, friends would tease me and stuff like that. Those weren't real friends, I eventually found out, you know. At the same time, my twin brother is a rock star. He's you know, was a huge academic star and was actually a great athlete, lettered in three sports at UW-Milwaukee, and is in their Athletic Hall of Fame. And so I was constantly being compared to him at school. The nuns called me the dumb twin and hold up our assignments together and say, look what the dumb twin did. You know, eventually the stress was so severe, I ended up in the hospital with a bleeding ulcer at age 10.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
And, you know, that's when the doctor found out what's going on. I mean, and I'm not trying to draw pity, because at the same time, my mother would take us in these incredible trips. You know, we'd go to DC and go to the White House, and I met, you know, presidents and governors. And so it's a very conflicted, weird kind of relationship, you know, with these two people. So I kind of buried it all and tried to go on, you know. It took me until I was really in the 30s and I was about to start my own family. My mother died this horrific overdose death on the day my first child, my son, was supposed to be born. I got a call at 6 a.m. that my mother had died, and my dad did it in his usual fashion. You know, he called at 6 and he said, "Pat," and I said, "Yeah, Dad, what's up?" You know, and it's never good to get a call at 6 a.m. I knew it was something bad. And he said, "Your mother died," you know, and I started crying. And he said, "Why are you crying?" And I said, "Dad, you know, my mother died, you know." And he said, "Well, people die, you know." And I said, "Come on, man, you know." So I had to deal with that all day while I was worried about my wife going into labor at any moment, you know. And I was on call that day and came back and did multiple deliveries. So I basically buried it. I finally went through some therapy, and man, a lot of stuff came out. I can tell you, it was like a volcano. So I, you know, when I started to write this book, I said to my twin brother, "I'm just going to tell the sports stories. I got so many stories about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Henry Aaron and Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio and the Baltimore Orioles and Reggie Jackson and Willie Mays and all these famous people, that's what I'm going to do. That's what people want to read." And he goes, "No, they don't. You know, they want to hear the whole story. They want to know who you are and where you came from." I said, "No, they don't, you know." And I'll tell you what, I've been on the road since last November with this book, and 80% of people went through some kind of dysfunction in their life. There's always crazy Uncle Eddie or right. You know, a parent and your grandpa. And 90% of the questions I get about are, you know, how'd you make it through there and what happened? And then how did you go on and have a career? And, you know, how'd you end up working for the Brewers, Bucks, and Packers? They don't ask me much about Kareem or Oscar or the championship or Henry Aaron. They just keep going back to home life and questions about that, because that's what they went through themselves.
You're exactly right. There are so many people who have experiences like that. My own father was an alcoholic. You and I have talked about that. Yeah, exactly. He died when I was 11, and that certainly affected me in profound ways that I didn't understand until I was an adult. But these are things that we can't talk about in general society. You can share sports stories, and everybody has this common culture. You know, did you see what so-and-so did yesterday in that game? And we love to talk about that because it's safe. But it's all of this hard stuff that you were incredibly courageous to share. And then parlay that to how it influenced you to seek experiences outside of your family and maybe even emboldened you to do some things that you may not have otherwise done. Like, for example, when you got involved with the Brewers. Tell us about how that happened.
Well, yeah, you bet. Before I say that I would have been dean of students if that happened, because I wanted to help all the students. But that's the final arc of the career. But, you know, I was really struggling with all that stuff at home. And Bud Selig was trying to get a team in Milwaukee, and he was trying to buy the White Sox. And it was, you know, we'd lost the Braves. It was really hard. And Milwaukee was actually really in mourning over the Braves and mad at baseball. And an ad appeared in the paper one morning, and you know, I hadn't been good at anything. I was really starting to go downhill, and the ad was to be the first bat boy for the Milwaukee Brewers. And so
how old were you at the time?
I was 15.
Okay.
And so I thought, well, what the heck, you know, I mean, might as well give it a shot. So I entered the contest, and I wrote an essay that was 25 words that said, "I want to be a bat boy because I would be doing a small part toward bringing baseball back to Milwaukee. I would hope the spirit I would show would be contagious." And I didn't know that at the time, but the contest was judged by Eddie Matthews, former Milwaukee Brave. Yeah, and Eddie Matthews picked my essay. And I was picked to be the first bat boy of the Milwaukee Brewers. And turns out, if you worked in that locker room and you worked really hard, the guy running the place said, "Hey, do you want to work for the Green Bay Packer games in Milwaukee at the time?" And it's like, when you're 15 and the Packers had just won 2 Super Bowls and, you know, in the late 60s, was like, "Do I want to work for the Green Bay Packers? Is that a question?" So suddenly I was working for two sports teams, and the Milwaukee Bucks had just become a franchise and they finished last. So they had a coin flip, and I had my transistor radio from my paper out and I was listening to the coin flip. When I heard they won the coin flip and they're going to get Lou Alcindor, I ran to the phone and I called the Milwaukee Bucks office and I said, how do you get to be a job to be a ball boy? And they said, we're interviewing tomorrow. And I took the bus down 25 cents and I interviewed with about 100 kids and I got picked to be on the Milwaukee Bucks bench. The trainer took a shining to me because I'd had some experience in the baseball locker room. And he and I became very close. And next thing I know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and I walked into our careers at the same time, and I was working for three professional sports, the only kid in America that's ever been able to do that.
Yeah, no kidding. So, well, before we get into, you know, kind of the people that you met, the big names, the big moments, what was the day-to-day like of being a ball boy on some of these teams?
You know, that's a really important question. I'm glad you asked it because that's really the next part of this. You know, I had to go to school and rearrange my schedule with my counselor to leave at about 2 o'clock so I could get there at 2:30, and we would be there all day and be done about 12:30 at night. In those days, they ignored the child labor laws. And yeah, we would clean the locker rooms, we'd clean the uniforms, we would do every errand for player, we'd be there until the game was over. Now they split the game in half and send these kids home and all that stuff. But I would take the bus, I'd be sitting in downtown Milwaukee, or I would ride my bike home from County Stadium. And, you know, when I get home, my parents would be passed out in their chairs or wouldn't even know what time I got home. It's 12:30, 1 o'clock at night. The first year I got paid $5 a game from the Brewers and $2.50 an hour from the Bucks. But it was heaven for me, you know, and I was out of that, you know, place of hell at home. And I'd study when I got home for school, and I'd get up early and study for school, and I'd study at study halls and get up and 2 o'clock and I'd get on the bus and do it again.
Did you sleep?
From about 2 o'clock in the morning till about 6 o'clock in the morning.
Wow. Yeah. So I have a 16-year-old son, and that would not work for him.
Yeah, prepared me to be a doctor.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. Trust me, being married to an OBGYN who, you know, she got up every morning at 5 to milk the cows and then milked them again, you know, when she got home from school. And now she just laughs because she has to get up at 5 every morning and she'll say, you know, my dad is still sleeping right now because he's retired from milking, but here she is up with the farmers. It's like, you never learn, but that's, you know, when you're trained that way. So in working with these teams, again, you talk about some of the folks that you got to meet, and we are in an era now, for better or for worse, maybe it's the millions of dollars they get paid or whatnot, but there's not a lot of great stories. There's a lot of prima donna stories out there because these people are making, you know, they're just in the stratosphere and such. It sounds like a much different era when, you know, people that we think of now as legends and celebrities, but they weren't making tens of millions of dollars a year.
Oh, no. I mean, I actually roomed with some of the Bucks players later in my career there when I was 20, 21, Brian Winters and Kevin Rustani. But they were making $35,000, $45,000. I mean, Kareem was making the most, you know. But, you know, the biggest salaries were $150,000, you know, that kind of thing. So most players, I would say the average salary for a Brewer or a Buck was probably around $55,000, $75,000 at the most. So they took second jobs. I mean, baseball players were working at the breweries and at car dealerships. I worked part-time I had five jobs because starting at age 12, I had to support myself. Every kid in our family had to completely support ourselves starting at age 12. I never got a dime from my parents. I bought my own clothes, paid for school, paid for transportation, all that. But so I took these extra jobs, and I was working at this car dealership with John McLaughlin, the guard for the Bucks, and Dick Cunningham, the backup center, and that's what they did.
Sure.
And these were great guys, fun to talk to and great to hang out with, and much more accessible than they are now.
And that's the big thing is being accessible, and those who otherwise just head right for their, you know, $100,000, you know, or more vehicle and scamper out of there as quick as they can. We're talking to Pat McBride. Luckiest Boy in the World is the name of his book, about his growing up, about his time with some major league sports teams. And then we're going to get into his career in health and medicine as well, coming up right after this break. You're up north.
From Lake Wissota, once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Green Bay, Green Bay, it gets scary Halloween day, screen face, Bloody Mary, secondary, Jordan, mean face.
We'll resume our conversation with Pat McBride, who's been a ball boy for the Packers, the Brewers, and the Bucks, coming up in just a minute. First, a reminder that in our next hour, we are going to have author Ron Fayola, who's written several coffee table books about Wisconsin supper clubs and their history, and we're really looking forward to hearing about the fourth edition of his book. Which one are you holding up there, Kristen?
First one.
Is that the first one? Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's the first one. Yep. Here's, I think this is number two. I think that one's number three. Yeah. So we're ready for another one.
Mm-hmm. That's important, Pat. I mean, supper clubs. Whew, that's important. Oh,
and they're, I mean, these books are great. And I could already merge these 2 hours just thinking about the supper clubs that, you know, the players and you and others went to around the Milwaukee area after some of these games, because they're just, you know, they were just amazing.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And some of them are still there. You can still go and visit, and they want to talk to you because they're family owned, which is the sense of community. And Pat McBride, I need to clarify, this is what your book is really about. It's about, there's so many different components to it. And it's almost like we were saying on the break when we were getting a little philosophical, it's almost surreal, all of the experiences that you've had. And as you talk about it, you have such a humble tone that as I'm reading, I'm like, really? He was the youngest, not ball boy, equipment manager for the Bucks. I mean, it's one thing after another, but it all comes back to a sense of community that you have built, but you were able to build it because others built it around you.
Yeah. You know, I was nicknamed Irish by Eddie Doucette, and the Doucettes took me in. You know, Eddie Doucette was so important to the growth of the Bucks, you know, by creating all those nicknames, you know, Johnny Mac and Bob Dandridge was the Greyhound and all that stuff. Everybody that listened to the Bucks then remembers all that. And I got to know Bob Uecker really well. And, you know, on road trips and hung with him, and he took me fishing out in his boat multiple times. And, you know, these people just, and John McLaughlin and his family are really close friends of mine. And these people just took me into their family. And so while I was going through all those struggles, I had a family outside of my family. And the trainer of the Bucks and the equipment manager at the, and clubhouse manager at the Brewers and Packers, they were just parents to me, and they mentored me. And the book is really an homage to my mentors that saw potential in me that I didn't see in myself. And I've spoken to a number of high schools and said, listen, you know, not one single adult in a high school reached out and said, you know, I was president of my class, you know, in high school, and I was president of the student council, and nobody said, hey, we know that you're having trouble at home, you know, but you're an okay kid, or, you know, listen, here's where you can get some help. You know, nobody did that, you know. And I said, as a kid, if you're having that kind of stuff, and I look around you, I'm telling you, 80% of the kids in this gymnasium are having this problem. I spoke at Tony Romo's high school in Burlington to 1,100 kids and said this, you know, said, you got counselors, you got psychologists, you got a great principal, you got great teachers. You know, it's different than when I grew up. Talk to them. And the principal called me and he said 12 kids walked into his office that day, you know. Sure. That was worth the whole thing. But, you know, I was lucky that the story is that I found mentors in the most unlikely place, which was the world of professional sports. And I had two people say to me, I said to them, you know, I want to be a trainer. You know, I'd love to be a trainer in professional sports. That's what I think my career was, because I just didn't think I was smart enough. You know, I got this crazy smart twin brother, you know. And they said, no, you're not going to be a trainer. you know, this was after they made me the youngest assistant trainer in professional sports history. And I said, well, what do you mean I'm not going to be a trainer? That's what I want to do. And they said, you're going to medical school. You're smart enough to go to medical school. And I'm like, what? I am? You know, I mean, they're telling me what I'm going to do. And they said, yeah, you're going to hang around with the doctors and you're going to learn what that's like. And they're going to tell you what it's like going to medical school, because that's what you're going to do. You're not going to work here. This is not for you.
Well, I was about to ask about making the pivot when you became interested in going to med school, but it was kind of thrust upon you. And so I guess I have to ask it this way. I mean, you're kind of making it sound like it was this big mystery, but you know, what do they see in me? But let's turn it the other way. What did they see in you? What is it that you were doing as an assistant trainer, and what, you know, what was it that they picked up on?
We picked up this draft choice that when Lou Alcindor was named the best player in the East, this guy was named the best player in the West, but he tore his ACL and had a bad knee in different times. They couldn't do what they could do now at these great knee surgeons, you know, the way the Packers have it and all that stuff. And so I started going to every rehab session this guy had. I was 16 years old and I thought, this is really interesting. And the trainer, I would start working with him and he taught me how to tape. And then I started helping tape at Packer games and stuff like that in the locker room, because I just thought it was really interesting. So I became the trainer of my high school football team and of the basketball team. So I was playing basketball, but I was also the trainer of the team. And so I took this course and then I was just taping all these guys, you know? So I was just seeking some kind of something that I could be good at, you know? And what happened really was that the moment I got the Brewers job and the Packers job, I felt like it was such a special opportunity that I never stopped running. There wasn't one second that I wasn't running at those jobs. So if they sent me from one locker room to the other, I sprinted the entire way. When I was on the field or in the arena, I sprinted from one place to the other. So like Eddie Doucette or Euchre would say, there goes the Irishman, he's sprinting, you know. So I still have recordings of that. And but I felt like I'm going to work as hard as I possibly can, because this is such a special opportunity. I never took them for granted those 7 years I was there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because I was working my second year, the Bucks won the NBA championship and I was there. And I just realized, this is incredible. I'm working with Robin Yount and I'm working with, you know who. So I think they said, wow, this is a really hardworking kid. And everything that they thrust on me as I was going into my senior year of high school, our equipment manager died. And he was a 55-year-old guy with three kids. Oh. And I called the Bucks office and I said, what are we going to do for these three kids? And I was talking to the trainer and he said, I'm going to put you in with the general manager, Mr. Wayne Embry. So I said, Mr. Embry, what are we going to do for the three kids? He said, we've already started a memorial fund for the three kids. I know the three kids still today. And I said, what are we going to do for a boss? And he said, we already have one. And I said, well, who's going to be our boss? And he said, you're going to do it. And he said, Irish, are you up for the job? And I'm going into my senior year. I'm trying to go out for the basketball team. And there was a nanosecond where I said, well, I kind of want to play basketball. And then I thought, all right, you dope. Do you want to be the equipment manager of the NBA champions? Or so I said, yes, sir, Mr. Embry, I'm up for the job. And then I had complete panic. I had a $100,000 budget. I'm 18 years old. You know, I'm the youngest equipment manager in pro sports history. As he said, get on the bus, come on down, and we'll go over the budget. And we went over the uniform budget and the tape and towels. And, you know, next thing I know, I'm out there as the equipment manager, and I became the assistant trainer. And that's how I grew up.
But then they, you know, they said you've got to go to med school. So yep. you did that. Yep. But much like you weren't expecting it, you've also said that, you know, in med school, it, you know, just because you're a hard worker doesn't make med school easy. Every med student finds that out. And, you know, there were moments of doubt there for you, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. So I just attended the funeral, unfortunately, of somebody that was instrumental in my life. Saw a bunch of my old guys there. And actually, I struggled pretty much in medical school because, you know, when I went to UW-Milwaukee, I was working as hard as I possibly could. I never did a social thing at UW-Milwaukee, not one social thing. because I'd go straight back to work, you know. And I was working about 50 to 70 hours a week. And so when I got to med school, I was just overwhelmed. There's, you know, 160 other really smart people, you know, and I was starting to really fail. I failed a really big exam, and I was flunking out. I was didn't know how to manage it. And I called the Buck's office and I spoke to this executive vice president, and I'll change the language a little bit. I said, "Hey, I'd like to come back and be the assistant trainer." And he said, "Irish, get your butt back in medical school." And he hung up on me. So I walked.
Not letting you quit.
No, he wouldn't let me quit.
Not letting you give up on yourself, basically.
Bingo. And it changed my life. I walked the streets for about 8 hours, and I realized I'd made a promise to myself, my future patients. You know, I'd written these essays that I was going to be this great doctor and everything. And I doubled down on my promise, and I did it. You know, I ended up in the top 25% of my class. And I, you know, I decided I was going to devote myself to being the best I possibly could. And that just that line, that phone, short phone call literally changed my life.
So Kristen, that's what you got to know him as, you know, we're really fast forwarding here, but in the time we have left, not just somebody who'd gone to med school, but is now an educator and mentor.
Well, yeah. And let's remind ourselves that much earlier in this conversation, Pat McBride was the dumb twin. And then he was handpicked to be, as a senior in high school, the equipment manager for the world champion NBA Bucks. And now here he is having this crisis, trying to figure out what he's supposed to do, but he commits himself and he figures it out. And I meet Pat McBride when I'm in medical school, and I have this very clear memory of, I just had my third son and I was sitting in your office and we were talking about my schedule and how I was going to balance motherhood and medical school and how we were going to change the schedule. And I remember you being so calm and accepting. And I was worried going into the meeting, even knowing who you were and what an incredible mentor you are. I was still worried that there were going to be expectations that I wasn't going to be able to meet. But you reassured me. We figured it all out. I made it through medical school. I think I'm doing okay now. But, you know, we all still have those self-doubts that we need people in our lives to remind us of our potential. And how you have been able to share some of the hard times and the doubts that you've had, that truly inspires me and so many others to recognize that we're not perfect, but that's okay because nobody is. And that shouldn't be a barrier for what we are able to achieve.
Yeah, I told many medical students that you're looking across the desk at the worst medical student in history. so trust me, we'll get through this together, you know? And I didn't have to coach Kristen very much, I can tell you that, but.
No doubt.
She was a rock star.
Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't have happened without that, you know, that education and that mentorship. And frankly, knowing that there's somebody that you can talk to, and I guess that's where we'll close here is, you know, whether it's as a child or as a student, you talking to those kids in Burlington as, mm-hmm. as a, you know, college and med student, but as an adult as well, we've been trying so hard for these years to shed that stigma of, you know, the whole rugged individualist and, you know, right. Bring yourself up by your bootstraps. And that's the one message I really get from you is it's more than okay to have some doubt and then ask for a little help and then get back to working hard.
Absolutely. You know, I talked to a lot of people actually, including the course of writing this book. One of my brothers said, "You got to write the whole thing." I said, "Please don't make me do that again. You know, don't go through all that." And I did, but I'll tell you for people that want to read this book is there's a lot of sports stories in there, but they're all metaphors about what life's about. They're what Joe DiMaggio taught me, and they're what Ted Williams taught me, and Bob Uecker, and what Kareem, you know, I talked to Kareem on his 75th birthday, and they're what they taught me. And I learned a lot from John McLaughlin, and I learned a lot from watching Oscar Robertson guide the Bucks to a championship and how you win and how you conduct your life. And I watched a lot of people act really badly in a locker room, and I watched a lot of people conduct their lives in a really positive way. When you're a young person and you watch people do things the right way and the wrong way, I go, I want to be like that guy doing it the right way. It was really powerful to me. And that's the story of this book, is who the right people were in my life as a young guy to get me where I got. And I owe my life to them.
That's great. Can you hang around for a couple more minutes?
I can.
All right. Well, let's take our final break, and then we'll wrap up this hour in our visit with Dr. Pat McBride right after this. You're up north.
Ceramic history, Pepper Belly. Once a packer, always a packer. Like Shakur, call me Tupac. I'm green and yellow. I'm green and yellow. I'm green and yellow.
Wireley is back with us as we continue our conversation with Pat McBride. Little Wind Beneath My Wings was your request for this.
Yes.
And I don't think it was tongue in cheek.
No, I picked the schmaltzy music because it's right. Mm-hmm. Pat McBride had the wind beneath his wings, and now he has been the wind beneath so many of our wings. And I'm really excited because we're going to be doing a book signing event here in Green Bay on November 20th at Hinterland Brewery. And we're going to invite all of our UW alumni to come and hang out with us and just reunite, create community, spend some time, tell some stories. Pat, I can't wait.
Come and hear about anybody you want to hear. Like, I'll tell you a funny story about Joe DiMaggio. I'm happy to share it now.
Please.
Do you want to hear about Joe DiMaggio?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm a 15-year-old kid. I'm really early in this job. I don't know anything. And I look down. I'm wearing an Oakland Athletics uniform. I'm the visiting bat boy. It's a very cool uniform, by the way. White shoes, yes, the yes. whole thing. Mm-hmm. Eventually got to drive Charlie Finley to the airport that night. But I look, and there's Joe DiMaggio sitting at a picnic bench all by himself. He's an Oakland Athletics coach, which was really weird. And I recognized him because he was doing Mr. Coffee commercials.
Right.
That's why we say, hey, I'm having a cup of Joe, you know? Mm-hmm. So I go, wow, it's Joe DiMaggio. So I go down there, and I got to figure out how I'm going to talk to him. So I say to him, hey, Mr. DiMaggio, can I ask you a question? And he says, sure, son, what is it? And I said, is it true that you leave a dozen red roses for Marilyn Monroe on her grave every week? And the guy looks at me like, did you really just ask me the most personal question? I mean, I eventually found out they had a very conflicted relationship. I mean, he loved her dearly, but they didn't get along.
Right.
So it was like my parents' relationship. So he says, it's true that I do that. And I said, you know, I think that's the sweetest thing I've ever heard in my life. And I said, I hope that someday I meet someone that I care that much about, that I would leave a dozen red roses for them every week. And he looks at me and he goes, well, thank you, son. That is really sweet. And then I said, could I have your autograph? I've got a picture of it in the book. So those kind of things would happen a lot, you know, where I'd do something dumb, but I'd end up on the other side with a knife.
All right. So there's our sweet athlete story for the moment. Again, forgive me for not being familiar with the book, but I'm going to ask anyway, does anybody, do you tell the story about the biggest jerk you ever met in the sports world?
Oh yeah. I've got a chapter. You know, I decided to, you know, I was going to tell the whole truth. You know, I have a friend that wrote another book that said he wasn't going to put anything negative. I don't believe in that. Mm-hmm. Not coming from a journalistic family. So I have a chapter called Hall of Fame and Hall of Shame. And I write about the worst five. Lou Piniella leads the list by a million miles because he used to, if he struck out, he'd tear the whole place up. I'll tell you a Willie Mays story. This is kind of astounding. A guy shows up at the locker room with a baseball signed by Mel Ott, who was a San Francisco Giant who had hit 511 home runs way back. And it's an old baseball that his grandfather gave him. And it's a Sunday morning and there's an old timers game, and Willie Mays is there with Stan Musial and Ernie Banks and all these very famous old guys. I was like, oh my God, there's baseball royalty in this locker room. And Willie Mays is sitting there telling all these stories and acting like a big shot. And the usher at the door says, hey, this guy's got this baseball and he'd like to have Willie Mays sign it because he's the next highest home run hitter, and they're also San Francisco Giants. So I take it to Willie Mays and I said, excuse me, Mr. Mays, this is a very famous baseball and it's very precious to this guy, and his grandfather gave it to him. And Willie Mays grabs the ball and starts bouncing it against the floor and the wall, bouncing it like that. And I said, excuse me, he wants it signed, and he does, and he just keeps bouncing it. And I'm not kidding you, Stan Musial and Ernie Banks, were their eyes were so wide they couldn't believe it. And I just grabbed the ball and I take it back to the poor guy and I said, excuse me, Mr. Mays is indisposed, and take it away. I mean, he was just an arrogant, you know what?
Yeah, he did not have the best end to his career, and sad to see, you know, ruining that kind of goodwill. So let's get back before we run out of time and find maybe, you know, one other person that, you know, would surprise people by, you know, either their kindness or, you know, something about their life story. What do people tell you when they read the book that they were most surprised by?
Yeah,
and all the figures you've met.
Three people that I would say they'd be most surprised. You know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar had this reputation for being cold, and because he'd put his head down and often just leave the arena. He's an extraordinarily shy, introverted guy. In the locker room, he is kind, funny, warm, unbelievably intelligent. He stays in touch. We're friends. He was a remarkable guy. In the basketball locker room, we're all college graduates, and they were playing chess and talking about jazz. Kareem had the world's largest jazz record collection. Delightful guy, and people have a different image of him. So he's a great guy.
Can't fly an airplane, though. I mean, that's what people remember.
That is absolutely still, right.
Still, and I still think that's got to be one of the best sports cameos ever. Was you know, him pulling that kid aside in the cockpit was just beautiful. I just loved it.
It
was great to see a sense of humor, you know?
Oh, it was beautiful.
For those of you who don't know what a long playing record is, that's from the old movie Airplane from the 70s. It's worth it.
There's not that many people that don't know Airplane yet.
I know. Sometimes when I talk about a rotary phone, Pat, you know.
Oh, my goodness. I loved the video of kids who can't operate a rotary phone. And in fact, I posted on Facebook over the weekend, I found on YouTube a 1940 film instructing people on how to use it, because a rotary phone was brand new technology in 1940. So they had to teach people how to use it. I thought that was amazing. So
wait. I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
We're getting short on time. So we've got 2 minutes. So it is my dream to meet Bob Uecker. Oh. I read Bob Uecker's book, Catcher in the Rye, W-R-Y, when I was like 10 years old. Same. And it was about him being on the road and like dropping condoms full of water out of windows. And I'm sure I didn't understand any of it, but I still thought it was amazing because he is such a delightful figure. So that is my sports dream. Pat McBride, I know that you have a sports dream that has something to do with the University of Wisconsin and jumping around and maybe wearing a suit.
Always wanted to be Bucky Badger.
And there it is. It's on the record.
Yeah. And Bob Uecker is what you see, what you hear on the radio, what you see on TV, what you saw in Major League. Mm-hmm. He is like that 24/7. You will be in tears cracking up around that guy all the time. We got to make that happen, Kristen.
All right, let's do it.
You absolutely should. I mean, of all the times I'd stay up late to watch Johnny Carson, it was Uke's appearances that really made it for me. Pat McBride, this was a wonderful hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. There's some great stories in there for you, Pat.
Yep, very much so. Can't wait. And Kristen, we'll talk more on the other side of the break about the event again so that people can attend. And then we will also have Ron Fayola, author of Supper Club books as well around Wisconsin, all after our top of the hour break. If you want our newsletter, go to upnorthnewswi.com, click newsletter in the top banner. We'll be back. You're up north.